Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Since the 2001 U.S. invasion ousted the Taliban from power in Afghanistan, the Taliban has recharged and returned. They're now sharply challenging the U.S. and NATO and the Kabul government in Afghanistan and the central government next door in Pakistan. What the U.S. should do next in the region has everything to do with how you perceive the Taliban. This hour on Point, understanding the Taliban now. You can join the conversation. How do you see the Taliban? Are these people the U.S. should work with, defeat, co-opt, leave alone, ignore? Joining us today from Washington is Peter Bergen. He's a longtime journalist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation, where he co-directs the Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative. In 1997, he produced the first television interview with Osama bin Laden for CNN. He's written several books on terrorism, including The Osama bin Laden I Know and Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader. Peter Bergen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for asking.
And joining me in the studio is Michael Simple, a regional specialist focused on Afghanistan and Pakistan, currently a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard. He's worked in the AFPAC region for more than 20 years, most recently as deputy head of the EU mission to Afghanistan. He was expelled from Afghanistan in 2007 by the Karzai government for talking with the Taliban. He's now based in Islamabad. His new book out last month is Reconciliation in Afghanistan. Michael Simple, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, how are you, Tom?
Well, Peter Bergen, if we could just go for a moment to the news of the day. 14 Americans dead, helicopters down. We heard over the weekend about Afghan students in the streets protesting what they had been told by the Taliban, I guess, was the desecration of a Quran. U.S. denies. Taliban kind of crowing over all of this. What's the moment we're at in Afghanistan as you see it, Peter?
Well, the Taliban understand that the center of gravity in this conflict is the American public, and the American public is turned against this war. And there's a very limited window for real progress to be shown. That's true on the liberal side of the Democratic Party, where David Obey, who's the head of the Appropriations Committee, 6 months ago said Obama essentially had a year. Now, David Obey has control of the money, in a sense, in this war. 51 House Democrats voted against funding for the war in May. That number is surely going up. Today, the president is meeting again with his advisors to discuss what the best approach is. But clearly, the window is closing because the American public is really turning against this war.
And Michael Simple, I want to ask you about the moment in Afghanistan, the balance of power there. On Fox News Sunday, the Afghan president runoff challenger, Abdullah Abdullah, was asked if there's a danger that the Taliban will overrun Afghanistan.
If the situation is not reversed from deteriorating further, the security situation, the future of this country will be at risk.
Abdullah Abdullah challenging Hamid Karzai for the presidency of Afghanistan. It appears that he supports General McChrystal's call for more troops in Afghanistan. We'll talk about that. But what about the stability, the moment, the balance of power of what momentum, Michael Semple, NATO, Kabul government, Taliban?
In Afghanistan, it's the start of the long run. It's a time of battle for the hearts and minds and opinions of the Afghan population, whether they believe that the Taliban are going to be defeated or eventually, as Dr. Abdullah threatened there, overrun the Kabul government.
So public opinion in the U.S. kind of in the balance, public opinion in Afghanistan as well?
Absolutely.
All of our heads have been turned by the accounts of David Rowe, the New York Times reporter who was held by the Taliban for 7 months. He's come out saying that what he saw in captivity was a much more organized, in charge, fierce, determined Taliban than he kind of imagined from the outside. What have you made of that depiction, Michael?
I think what he has described is, first of all, interesting because where it was. It was not in Kandahar, which was the heartland of the traditional Afghan Taliban that we know, the Taliban led by Mullah Umar.
Southern Afghanistan.
Yes, it was in Waziristan. which is across the border in Pakistan, and which is shifted further east, and which is dominated by a totally different set of people from those who dominated the main Taliban movement headed by Mullah Omar. The network that held David is known as the Haqqani network. The followers of Jalaluddin Haqqani, the fighters are now led by his son Siraj Haqqani. They are from a different set of tribes from the Mullah Omar's original supporters, and they've got a different pattern of alliances and a different agenda. What David Rhodes saw was another Taliban from the Taliban that we are familiar to from 10 years ago.
And how is it different? Is it more problematic than the Mullah Omar Taliban defeated by U.S. troops in the Northern Alliance in 2001? Is it different in character in an important way? It's focused. It's based in Pakistan and focused more on the Pakistani government. But what about its basic character?
In terms of its international linkages, whereas there's been a lot of discussion over the past few weeks about how few actual Al-Qaeda operatives are there in Afghanistan, if there is any part of the movement which has got strong linkages with Al-Qaeda, which is dependent upon the support and presence of many of the fighters from Al-Qaeda, it is this Haqqani network who held David Rhodes for all of those months. They are also closely linked to the jihadi movements inside Pakistan and are widely perceived to be receiving support from some parts of the establishment in Pakistan.
It's a jihadi movements such as Al-Qaeda?
As well as Al-Qaeda, they are closely linked to the Pakistani jihadi movements, which also means that they have access to a network of madrasas which are sympathetic to Pakistani jihadi movements across the whole of the north of Pakistan.
Peter Bergen, as I read you and Michael Semple, Michael comes down in the territory, and we'll hear it from him, but in the territory of we can somehow work with and perhaps co-opt the Taliban or parts of it, importantly. I read you saying something more like we must confront and defeat the Taliban. Maybe that's too simple a summary, but if that's the general direction, why?
Well, I mean, you know, Michael knows more about this than anybody in the world, so I will defer to him. But I would just make some just general observations about reconciliation with the Taliban, which, of course, is highly desirable. But there are several obstacles, I think, to it. And one, we've sort of run this videotape a few times before on the other side of the border. Multiple peace agreements were done with the Pakistani Taliban, all of which were broken, all of which were reneged on. And the Taliban took these peace agreements as opportunities to actually expand their reach, for instance, most recently in Swat. Secondly, Mullah Omar has made no effort to say that he's willing to negotiate. Thirdly, the Taliban don't either think they're winning the battle or at least not losing, which in an insurgency amounts to the same thing. And people, generally speaking, armed groups don't sue for peace when they feel that they're doing well. And I think that there are some sort of structural problems with this idea. It's obviously an idea that worked in Iraq, but there's a big difference between Iraq and Afghanistan in the sense that Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which Americans were very successful in getting Sunni tribal groups to rise up against, and was basically a foreign-led organization. The Taliban on both sides of the Afghan-Pakistan border are people who grew up, and they're not importing a completely foreign ideology as Al-Qaeda in Iraq did in Iraq. The Taliban's views on the way to organize society are pretty common in rural Pashtun areas. So, there are a lot of caveats, but of course, and a sort of counterpoint also is that there has been a process of the Taliban being reconciled in Afghanistan. It's been going on for years, and thousands of sort of lower-level people have come over. This is not a new idea. But Michael knows a great deal about the specifics of this, and so I defer to him.
Michael Semple, is there a counterpart or a body in the Taliban that the U.S., NATO can reconcile, Kabul can reconcile with, work with, a way other than confrontation, or not?
It is important to recognize that the Taliban, who took over the country in They started their movement in 94. They captured the capital in 96. They ran the government for 5 years from then. They are now a part of the political landscape inside Afghanistan. They're not some kind of completely shadowy organization that we don't know who they are and who to talk to. Yes, of course, there is a potential political counterpart. Peter's absolutely right when he says they're not dealing. On a political level at the moment, they're absolutely not dealing. I think part of the reason is because they believe that they have more to gain at the moment by pursuing the military track. Part of the movement is because efforts at reconciliation or even a political engagement so far from the government or international side have been fitful. They have not been pursued seriously. And also it's something to do with the nature of the beast. Although they're part of the political landscape in Afghanistan, those of us who had experience of dealing with them, even in the era when it wasn't a question of trying to sort out some great peace accord, it was more dealing on more practicalities in the late 90s when the international community was in Afghanistan in a small way. They've got a particular worldview and they are tricky to deal with. It's the nature of the beast. It's the inadequacy of the efforts so far, and it is the dynamic that Peter rightly points to. That while the hardline faction of the movement can point to the waverers that give us another year, we'll push the US out. That is probably the strongest single deterrent for any meaningful political engagement.
What is the strongest single deterrent?
The ability of hardliners in the Taliban movement to talk to their pragmatist colleagues. There
and
are
say, we've
pragmatists
almost got it done
saying,
here.
just stick with us, push harder, we'll get
way.
The Americans out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Taliban and whether the U.S. could work with them, whether they must be defeated, whether that's possible or necessary. My guests are Peter Bergen, senior fellow at the New American Foundation, author of The Osama Bin Laden I Know, and he did and does interviewed him in 1997 for CNN. He's editor of the AFPAC channel at foreignpolicy.com, joins us today from Washington. With me in the studio, Michael Semple, former deputy head of the EU mission to Afghanistan, kicked out by the Karzai government in 2007 for talking with the Taliban. He's now at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University. His new book is Reconciliation in Afghanistan. Michael, Peter, we have a lot of callers. Let's go right to Keith in Boston. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Hello, Tom, hi. Peter, and Michael. My name is Keith LaFour, and I'm actually a combat photojournalist. I'm based here in Boston, but recently I spent a year in Afghanistan working for the International Security Assistance Force, and essentially I had two roles. One was to run a team of Afghan print and radio journalists in Regional Command East, and also I ran with the troops as a combat photojournalist and embedded extensively with the 82nd, 101st Airborne, the Marines, French Special Forces, the Brits, and the Afghan National Army. And I essentially wanted to come on the air and just give my impressions of the Taliban, since, again, I've been on the front line. And, in fact, actually, I was in Afghanistan when Michael was asked to depart hastily.
Christmas Day, 2007. What's your Taliban impression?
Well, my impression is that I know there's been a lot of discussion and debate, and particularly amongst the liberal establishment. They play them off as liberal do-gooders, but I got to tell you, from what I see on the ground in the field, I see incredible brutality. And this is, I've seen children that have been strapped with explosives. They go in and they'll decapitate villagers that are seen to be fraternizing with the quote-unquote enemy. Public executions. I've seen young children who have had, girls who have had acid thrown on them because they went to schools, or rather they went to school. And when we go into villages, fear is palpable. And part of the problem, for instance, in Helmand Province, where I actually ran with the Royal Scots and the two Scots and the Royal Irish, was that you would go into a village and they would take the village, and sometimes they would take casualties taking the village, but then they didn't have sufficient troop strength to hold the village. And when they'd be forced to pull out all Afghans that had actually shown any amiability toward them would then be severely persecuted or killed. And so the question becomes, would it have been better not to have even gone into these villages than to try and fail like that? But Hello?
Yes, and so the villagers paid the price once they were vulnerable again to the Taliban. Keith, let us pick up your perspective. Michael, I'll come first to you. Brutal, determined, doesn't sound like a partner in conversation, and doesn't sound like Keith would welcome that.
If you were to look at the background of some of the Afghans who are currently pillars of the establishment in the government that the United States is working closely with there, if you were to look back into their past and ask what were they doing exactly 30 years ago, exactly 30 years ago when people who are today in their early 50s were in their early 20s, they were targeting anybody associated with the regime with assassinations. They were putting out, sticking up leaflets around the place saying spies will be killed. They were rounding up villagers who had accepted guns from the regime in attempts to form militias. They were terrorizing their way to dominate the areas. That was the start of the movement, which became the jihad, which overthrew the Soviets. Those same people have passed through that, and now they are pillars of the establishment. The idea is absolutely not how to somehow empower the Taliban or effect some kind of Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, which I entirely agree would be bad for the Afghans and bad for the international community. The point is how to stabilize Afghanistan by splitting off the people who are who are directing the kind of atrocities that that Keith witnessed from those who take a more pragmatic view of it.
Conversation versus confrontation. Peter Bergen, you seem to come down more on the confrontation side. I mean, do you see some part of the Taliban is just organically Afghan and ready to be talked with, worked with, brought over time somehow here? What about the idea that that's not that can be done, or the opposite, that they have to be confronted more directly, that any victory there is a kind of Al-Qaeda victory, in effect?
Well, I mean, it's not an either-or category. I mean, as we've discussed earlier in the program, there's been a reconciliation process for low-level Taliban that has brought thousands of people over out of the insurgency. At the upper levels, the Taliban, I think, needs to be defeated militarily. Just to kind of comment on what Keith said, it's an interesting fact that when you poll on the question, what's your view of the Taliban, right now they've got a 7% favorable. It's never gone above 10% in the last several years that these polls have been done.
So in what locale?
These are national polls conducted by, we've had multiple polls in Afghanistan conducted by the Asia Society, BBC, ABC, and other organizations. And they're very useful in terms of trend data, and the fact is the Taliban is widely despised in the country. Now, obviously, if you're in Helmand, it's a little different. But I was just in Helmand, and I think the most telling conversation we had was with a village elder who was asked by a Marine lieutenant colonel, "Are you happy we're here?" And his answer was very simple, and I think it gets to the heart of this issue, which was, the U.S. military is very strong. The Taliban are very strong. I'm very weak. I mean, he didn't take a position on whether he liked the U.S. military or not. It's just a fact of life that the worst thing that we can do is go into places and not hold them, puts these people that we're supposed to be helping in an untenable situation.
If it's only 7% support from the Afghan people, how does that square with, we're hearing widely these days that even from General McChrystal in a roundabout way, that the Taliban is winning?
Well, they're not losing. I'd make that distinction. In an insurgency, not losing is a form of winning because you're just trying to wait somebody out. I mean, just getting back to what we talked about at the beginning of the program, Dr. Abdullah's comment that without international forces, the Taliban would come into Kabul. He's made that comment to me directly before, and I think that's true. But obviously, international forces are going to remain in the country. And the Taliban is not some massive military force. The idea that it could mount a sort of Tet-style offensive on Kabul right now, it doesn't make any sense. It's about 20,000 strong, maybe 10,000 strong 3 years ago. Michael might have a comment on these numbers. It's militarily a major tactical problem, but it is not a strategic problem. There is a sort of distinction here. This is not a rerun of the Vietnam War in that sense. The Taliban is not backed by massive states like the Soviets backed the North Vietnamese. The North Vietnamese army had 500,000 men and had artillery. So it's a highly effective insurgency that isn't losing, is the way I would sort of try and frame it.
Michael Semple? Do you go with that? It's not losing. Does that mean it's winning? General McChrystal says if he doesn't have 40,000 more troops, it's mission failure within a year, potentially. Within the last day, we've seen unnamed Kabul officials saying if foreign troops were to go 24 hours, then the Taliban would be in control of Kabul.
Peter's absolutely right in saying that the Taliban are not in a position to mount some kind of mass assault on urban areas in Afghanistan. And indeed, to give you a flavour of some of the conversations that I have with them in trying to push push them towards political engagement. I spend my time listening to some of their morale boosting stories, and then making the point to them that they are failing to achieve any of the objectives that they credibly have. If you go back to the 90s. Between 1994 and 1996, the Taliban swept across the whole of southern Afghanistan and captured the capital in 2 years. Mm. It's been 8 years now, and they have not managed to capture a single one of Afghanistan's 34 provinces. Ostensibly, they seek to drive out the foreign forces and topple the puppet regime. In 8 years, they've demonstrated no progress towards that. But they
No progress?
They have made. They have failed to secure any major population center. They have inflicted untold damage on the population, the country at large. They've been wasting this opportunity for Afghans to rebuild their country after the real jihad up to 1992. So I consistently make the case to them that despite all the rhetoric about inflicting losses upon on the US or the internationals, actually they're making no progress to their own stated goals.
John in Des Moines, Iowa. John, you're on the air. Hi, John.
How are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Look, this sounds like a situation of if you can't beat them, join them. This is totally against our values. We put wife beaters in jail in this country. If parents don't send their kids to school, they get in big trouble. What are we doing there in the first place? If we can't beat the 20,000 force ragtag group, maybe we don't have any business being there in the first place. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you very much.
John, thank you. Let me get one more. Martha in Cambridge. Martha, you're on the air.
Well, in a somewhat similar vein, I don't think that we should be fighting the Taliban. They're horrible, 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 but so are other regimes around the world, quite a number of them. It's not what we're supposed to be doing. If we want to go after Al-Qaeda, that is another matter. Let us focus specifically on that, but not the Taliban, not how to keep Afghan together. I mean, I'm listening to a conversation that consists of what is the best means to deal with the Taliban and Afghan, and that is not where we should be starting from.
Martha, we've got that as well. Let me get one more. Dave in Storrs, Connecticut. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just want to raise the point, we've been discussing this for a number of weeks now, which is great, and you hear lots of expert opinions and analysis on your shows, Charlie Rose, whatever. Mm-hmm. It just seems, in reality, there are numbers that if you really wanted to make this happen, it would take, over 200,000 troops, and if this is really such a global threat, why can't the world just come together, put together a very large international force, and just get in there, occupy, hold, and change this for the better? I mean, it just seems like either it's worth it to the world or it's not. It just seems to be getting late in the hour.
A war of necessity or it's not. Peter Bergen, let me bring that to you. President Obama called it a war of necessity, but the discussions in the Situation Room at the White House are said to be very wide-ranging. Martha says, let's just go after Al-Qaeda. Let's take that on when it comes to global threat. Are these separable, the Taliban confronting the U.S. and NATO in Afghanistan and Taliban across the border in Pakistan from Al-Qaeda? Can it be isolated as a kind of a local conversation or not, Peter?
You know, we've already run this videotape a couple of times before, and we know what the outcomes are. The first time was when we closed our embassy there in 1989, washed our hands of the country, zeroed out aid to one of the poorest countries in the world during the 90s. Into the vacuum came the Taliban, and they brought al-Qaeda with them, and they embedded together, as it were. Then in 2001, we ran the videotape again. This time we did it because of an ideological version to nation building by the Bush administration. We did it on the cheap, and we got what we paid for, which was the Taliban back, partially, this time much more closely allied ideologically and tactically to al-Qaeda. We now have a third bite of the apple, which is essentially to do something real. And I think if you look at the situation in any sort of serious manner, you have to say that the decision that will come out of the White House will be a fairly substantial troop increase. We're not going to get... We have a real coalition in Afghanistan, unlike in Iraq. There are more than 40 countries, including, by the way, small presence of actually Muslim troops from Jordan and Qatar, a very substantial British troop presence, 35,000 European soldiers fighting or at least participating in some way in the war in Afghanistan. But I think that, you know, the last caller was correct. I mean, if you just do the math, clearly it's still under-resourced. There's still not enough boots on the ground. And I think that one of the reasons that this has been such a deliberative process is that they are working towards a number which will end up looking a lot like 40,000.
Michael Semple, what's your prescription here? You're talking more about reconciliation. You're saying there are elements, important elements of the Taliban that can be flipped toward away from that kind of agenda. What would you tell President Obama now? What would you advise?
For all the callers who are wondering, you know, is it really important for the U.S. to maintain its commitment to Afghanistan, I think there are very strong reasons to say the answer is yes. Just think back from the prospect of what would happen if the U.S. pulled out too quickly. It would be a disaster. But the point is that if the U.S. is going to maintain its commitment, it's important to get smart. It is important to maintain a robust military stance. It's important to do it in a way that the U.S. and its allies can sustain it, because the reality is it is going to take a long time to fix Afghanistan. It's something which we know is not going to happen overnight. So do it in a way that we can run with it in the long term. But until now, there's been massive investment on the military side. It's important to balance that military investment with attempts to do it politically. Part of the politics is, that we've been talking about is engaging with the Taliban and pointing out both the futility of their pursuit of the military option, because they are not going to win, and the realistic options for the pragmatists inside the Taliban to be cut into the political system in Afghanistan on reasonable terms. And there is another element to the political process, which is making serious progress on building up the effectiveness of the Afghan government, without which there's little chance of solving Afghanistan.
But Peter Bergen, do you agree that the Taliban's effort is futile, that they're not going to win? That doesn't seem to be their own sense of themselves lately.
Well, I think Michael pointed out very, very properly that, you know, 8 years into the conflict, they don't control a single province. I mean, even back in I obtained an Afghan army assessment of kind of a district by district assessment of the 400 or so odd districts. You know, relatively few were actually controlled by the Taliban, and probably even fewer today because of the Marines going into Helmand. But I wanted to raise another issue, which I think is related to some of the things we're talking about. I think it's time for us to sort of forget about sort of fancy counterinsurgency doctrines about connecting the Afghan people to their government. Afghans have not had much experience of good government in their lives and don't really expect it. But what we're not really delivering now is something much more basic, which, as Hobbes pointed out during the English Civil War, the main duty of government is providing security, and we're not really doing that. I mean, to give you one very concrete example, the most important road in the country politically and economically is the road between Kabul to Kandahar. In 2005, you could take a cab, as I did, picked at random in Kandahar Bazaar and drive that road without incident. Now you'd be basically committing suicide doing that. If we can't secure the most important road in the country, you know, we are basically failing. And so that we need to get the security thing right. A lot of other things flow from that after you get that right.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Taliban now and U.S., NATO, world options in dealing with them. Peter Bergen is with us from the New America Foundation in Washington. He's for a big increase in troops, as we have to do it. Michael Semple is author of the new book, Reconciliation in Afghanistan, maybe for more troops, but not as many, and maybe not for long. We'll ask him about that. I want to ask each of you about the Taliban and al-Qaeda and their relationship today, and maybe it's different, Michael, for the two groups that you described right at the outset, the Haqqani Taliban, the more Waziristan, Pakistan-based, Mullah Omar's Afghan Taliban, much of which is also in Pakistan, but different. How do you describe the relationship between these and al-Qaeda? Do they share that al-Qaeda goal of the caliphate from, you know, Pakistan to Istanbul, or... You know, is there a sharp distinction between the relationship? Please tell us.
The bulk of the Taliban, the ones who were involved in the movement during the 90s, are fighting a war. They're trying to shoot their way back into power. They will take assistance from any source that they can get it. At the moment, one of the important sources is al-Qaeda. They receive funding as well from other parts, other sources inside the Middle East, not necessarily from al-Qaeda. And they remain doggedly committed to their own objectives without buying the whole agenda of the donors, a problem which donors face all over the world. Mm-hmm. We face that problem as well. If you want to turn it over and ask what's the real agenda of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan at the moment, I suspect that the thinkers in al-Qaeda are very doubtful of their ability to establish any new caliphate inside Afghanistan. What they're using Afghanistan for at the moment is a great big film studio. They are creating photo opportunities of seeing jihadi fighters attacking Humvees, making footage of this and beaming it around the world, selling it in the Middle East, collecting funds and mobilizing new recruits on the basis of this. A point which I think is made quite quite clearly from by David Rode and his experience in Waziristan, where he keeps on referring back to the importance of the video makers. Whereas the original Taliban that we knew in the 90s, for them, the visual arts were sort of a forbidden fruit. They banned television and the and moving images. Now suddenly the film is integral to the operation because it's such a big bit propaganda and fundraising tool.
Peter Bergen, how about it? A great big film studio or a goal of making it a real base for the pursuit of al-Qaeda's aims, which go quite a ways beyond Afghanistan?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with what Michael just said, and I would what has happened is the Taliban has basically taken the al-Qaeda playbook entirely to heart. One very obvious way is in the video production that Michael talked about, but also if you look at the suicide attacks, ID attacks, beheadings of hostages. Essentially, these ideas were either copycatted or learnt directly from al-Qaeda in Iraq. There is a lot of evidence of people from the tribal regions going to Iraq and vice versa to get on-the-job training. There's a brilliant series in Newsweek just a couple of weeks ago by Sami Yousafzai, a journalist who's had very good dealings with the Taliban. In which there's a very extensive description of the way the Arabs essentially worked as special forces, an analogous to our special forces.
Embedded with Taliban units here.
Embedded with Taliban units, relatively small numbers, but working as advisors. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and the Haqqani network that we've spoken about have links with bin Laden that go back to the late 80s. I mean, these are people who have... These are very good friends and with very long-standing relations. The Taliban, writ large, you go into Helmand, there is no al-Qaeda presence in Helmand. But if you go into, as David Rode indicated in his article, the Haqqani network seem to be very much embedded into the foreign fighter elements in Waziristan. So, to answer your question about the relations between the al-Qaeda and the Taliban, it sort of depends where you're which part of the Taliban are you talking about?
But you describe Mullah Omar, of course, who was the head of the Afghan Taliban, as now essentially al-Qaeda's religious guide, commander of the faithful, the title given him.
Yes. Well, I mean, al-Qaeda, like and every other Taliban group, has signed on to Mullah Omar being commander of the faithful, which is, by the way, an interesting title because it does suggest a global mission, even if it's preposterous. This is a title from the Prophet Muhammad's time. The idea that you not only command the Afghan faithful, but you command all Islam, all Muslims around the world is the inference of this title. Al-Qaeda has taken this oath of allegiance to Mullah Omar, and as have every other Taliban commander. And, Mullah Omar has been strikingly silent on a rather important issue, which is the basis of any future negotiation, according to all involved, which is a rejecting al-Qaeda. All he has to do is just come out with one statement to that effect. He's never done it. And as Michael also correctly pointed out, the basis of any future conversation with the Taliban is that international forces will leave, according to the Taliban. Well, that's a non-starter also. So, the reconciliation process is absolutely the right thing to do, but at the upper levels, these guys don't want to reconcile.
General McChrystal says, more troops, maybe a lot more, or mission failure. Would a Taliban victory mean an al-Qaeda victory in Afghanistan, in Pakistan? Is it one and the same then, or not?
Well, I mean, I think the answer to that is, of course. I mean, we've already done this experiment. We don't need to rerun it again. I mean, a Taliban victory in 1996, almost immediately al-Qaeda moved and became one and the same with the Taliban at that point. I mean, the al-Qaeda was very useful to the Taliban because they were a relatively strong fighting force, the 55 Brigade, which was essentially the shock troops the Taliban used against the Northern Alliance in their battle. So, history has already demonstrated that if the Taliban took over, that al-Qaeda would come back. And history also suggests that Mullah Omar is not some sort of Henry Kissinger-like figure who suddenly is going to become, the master of realpolitik as a victory approaches. He was prepared to lose everything on the point of principle of bin Laden, and he did after 9/11. This is not a rational actor in the way that, just because foreign policy realists say that, the Taliban can behave more realistically, doesn't mean that they necessarily will. That's really a form of projection of our own values or thinking on other people. And Mullah Omar is not a rational actor.
Michael Semple, Taliban victory and al-Qaeda victory or not necessarily? We talked with Rory Stewart not so long ago, British military figure, diplomatic figure. He was saying, look, you don't ultimately need to be in Afghanistan. It's always going to be a rugged, difficult place. You can't control it. Let's figure out how to move away from it and let it work itself out. But al-Qaeda is cited as the reason that can't be done, that they have global reach, which we saw on 9/11, and so you've got to pay attention. Taliban and al-Qaeda joined at the hip if it were a victory or not. Is there a way to separate these things?
First of all, we should be very careful on not to misrepresent Rory Stewart's argument. Rory Stewart's argument, wherever it goes, does not involve a precipitate withdrawal from
Indeed.
Afghanistan.
Because but withdrawal was a theme. It may be longer term, it's certainly not precipitate, but he's saying you can't run Afghanistan. It's never been done from outside.
That's the whole point. Any attempt to establish some kind of a U.S. colony or international protectorate in Afghanistan would be disastrous. The point is how to stabilize Afghanistan so that it does not require a permanent military presence or the prospect of foreigners trying to run the country. It would be a disaster to walk away now. A Taliban victory undoubtedly would be exploited by al-Qaeda. At the moment, we should acknowledge that there is a struggle for the soul of the Taliban. Those who say that there are Taliban pragmatists who just want to have a share in power in Afghanistan are correct. Those who argue that there is a part of the Taliban who are wedded to the al-Qaeda agenda of hitting back at Western interests wherever they may exist in the Muslim world, driving the infidels out of the Muslim world, are correct. The point is there is a struggle within the Taliban movement for supremacy. The withdrawal of the U.S. precipitately, allowing a Taliban victory, would result in a victory for the Al-Qaeda version of that. It undoubtedly, Afghanistan would be exploited as an example that the West is in retreat, that as an example that international legitimacy that was represented by the UN endorsement of the intervention in Afghanistan is meaningless, as an example that all those who cooperate with the United Nations or with other aspects of the international community stands to have their throats cut, as many of our current Afghan allies would, it would be a disaster. That's something which we cannot tolerate. But in avoiding that, the key thing is to be smart. Because when we realize that Al-Qaeda is exploiting the current military confrontation to make themselves stronger, that the Taliban are appealing to the Afghan population from their base of 7% support amongst the Afghans, they're appealing to the Afghans saying, this is some kind of a nationalist struggle. We are fighting against the foreign military forces. It's important for us to maintain the robust stance, but in a way that diffuses the propaganda both of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
What would that mean in number terms to you? Does that mean 40,000 troops, as General McChrystal reportedly has requested? Is it less?
I'm not going to do the military planning. There are people who are charged with that. The important thing is it should be a robust stance, and a robust stance which can be sustained long enough to be able to get the job done.
Is there not a diminishing presence option here? I mean, people have talked about the sort of drone control, pull back and fight the Al-Qaeda when and where necessary from the skies.
I'd want to see it planned out. I don't think that something which involved allowing the Taliban sort of to take over the southern provinces of Afghanistan would probably escalate the conflict at a time when we want to see the conflict diminishing. I'd have thought that rather than relying on drones to be able to zap a few Taliban targets, realistically you're going to see that kind of rollback when the Afghan security forces become more effective, and also if there is progress on the political agenda, progress on the political engagement with the Taliban.
But a reconciliation, your word in your title, an option with that wing of the Taliban that is more pragmatically oriented with time, force plus what, development? I mean, where does reconciliation come in here? What does it look like?
If the international allies of Afghanistan, particularly the U.S., are able to maintain their robust stance, are able to work with the Afghan government to build up the Afghan security forces, at the same time as the Afghan government and its allies pursue the reconciliation stance, it should be possible to split off those Taliban who actually are interested in a solution inside Afghanistan from those who are committed to a perpetual conflict.
Let me get a call from Kim in Boston. Hi, Kim, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. As we consider what we should be doing in Afghanistan, I think it's important that we remember that it's our loved ones, our husbands and wives and mothers and fathers and sons and daughters that are there. So I think it's encouraging that so many people are weighing in on the situation. I think it's also important that we keep in mind why we went into Afghanistan, and that was to weed out Osama bin Laden and his followers. And we're there, and the U.S. needs to stay there until we, accomplish this mission to some extent. Maybe we'll get bin Laden, maybe we won't. What I think is important is that we have some sort of dialogue or reconciliation or resolution with bin Laden and his followers. And I say that from the perspective of a woman who lost her husband on 9/11. If we pull out of Afghanistan now, these people aren't just going to say, oh, they're gone, let's roll up our sleeves and go back to doing whatever we were doing before they arrived. If we pull out, it's just going to further motivate them and build their forces and continue to cause ill will toward the U.S. As we think about a military solution and going in with greater forces, I think we should also keep in mind that we need to help the Afghans respond to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda better. And I see a way to do this through economic development. Let's do something to relieve some of the abject poverty and the desperation that arises there. And that will help the Afghans respond to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban on their own. It will give them strength. It will give them power. It will help them build and fortify their government.
Kim, thank you for calling and reminding us of losses we saw there. 9/11, of course, losses now as well. Thank you very much. Peter Bergen, do you see the White House lining up toward a strategy that looks effective to you here?
Yes, is a short answer. I mean, the idea that we should just sort of narrow down to a counterterrorism mission has a back-to-the-future flavor.
As opposed to counterinsurgency and nation-building and the rest?
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's just drones and special forces, I mean, we already did that, basically, in the first several years of our engagement in Afghanistan. But I would like to raise a slightly different point, Tom, which is I think the White House may have made a mistake, an understandable one, by framing this only about al-Qaeda, because then it's easier to say, well, let's just do a counterterrorism mission and we'll take care of it that way. There are other interests at stake. One is we really don't want a return of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan multiple reasons. I mean, multiple very obvious reasons about the Afghans themselves and our commitments. We overthrew their government. We have a sort of moral responsibility to make it a little bit better than it was when the Taliban came in. And finally, we have, you know, regional stability is a very important American good in this region. You know, an unstable Afghanistan tends to create an unstable Pakistan, and the fifth largest country in the world shortly in terms of population, nuclear weapons. There are some other things that are at stake here. It's not just about al-Qaeda, even though I you know, firmly believe that that's a very important thing.
Though we're there now, and it hardly seems to have grown more stable. Last word, Michael, goes to you. Do you see reconciliation really on the horizon here, or quagmire, more war?
The discussions that I've had with some of the Taliban leaders and commanders indicate, yes, it is possible, but it's not going to happen overnight. There's going to be a lot of hard work and more sacrifice before it's achieved.
Michael Semple, author of Reconciliation in Afghanistan, thank you for joining us. Peter Bergen at the New America Foundation, thank you as well. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.